You're listening to the Groundswell Sermon Podcast, a brand new church in the Halton region, Ontario, Canada.
First off, Happy New Year. And we got a, there you go. How did you celebrate New Year? Did you celebrate? How many here celebrated New Year? Did they? No? No, you're a pretty sedate group. Are you all sick like I was? I missed Christmas and New Year's thanks to a cold and sinusitis. So did anybody celebrate it? Oh, Ryan in the back, what'd you do? Made some French toast. There you go. Next year, if you're short of anything, French toast is the thing to do. Well, we're in the new year, as has been said, and quite poetically by Pastor Brian number one. So we are going to pay attention to that. But I hope you're ready to get back into the Sermon on the Mount for a couple of weeks. So far in our tracking through it, in the first three messages or four messages, well, I'm not sure what number we're at now, but we've seen Jesus explain what the character of the kingdom is to be like based on the Beatitudes, verses 3 to 12. And then our last message, we saw how Jesus explained the expectation that they were to live, the disciples were to live a righteousness beyond the Pharisees. And we'll look at that in a moment. So what we're looking at now, today's message and next week's message, is how that works out practically. How do we practically live a kingdom righteousness now on earth? And Jesus gives six examples of kingdom conduct, and we're going to look at the first one today, anger and reconciliation. That's the first example, and it really is the paradigm for the next five that come along. So next week, we'll look at those five as well. Does everybody have a sermon sheet? Everybody, if everybody wants one, if you don't have one, they'll get you one, but otherwise, they'll give you something to work through. So we're looking at the first one today, and next week we'll look at the whole list of them, because it's really an overview of righteous living. But before we get there, I want to ask, how do you respond when you feel anger? Perhaps anger about yourself, or anger about others. I saw the movie Inside Out. I haven't seen Inside Out 2 yet, but I saw Inside Out. But they have. From what I understand, people are using that movie to help them to kind of sort through why their emotions are so strong in their lives, especially people who were never really thought about that. So that's the anger character from Inside Out. It reminded me back into the pandemic that I read a news story that really shocked me, and it was about a couple taking their son into a store, but they didn't have a face mask. Do you remember that in the pandemic, that if you didn't have a face mask, you couldn't go in some way? Well, this, whatever they needed in this store for their son, they wouldn't let them in if he didn't have a face mask. And the store couldn't supply them with one, so they turned around and went home. But 2 hours later, they came back, the father and the son carrying a gun, and they shot and killed the store owner. Now, it's one thing to be turned away from a store, but what an literally overkill to come back and murder somebody for not letting them, or for not wearing a face mask. It tells you what kind of tense times we're living in and what happens when anger builds to a level that we probably don't even know how to handle. Some of the question for you as you begin 2025 is, are you dealing with anger? Are you dealing with any anger in yourself? Or with a family member? Or a loved one? or with a work associate or a school associate. I can understand not having a good handle on anger, because for years I didn't believe I was angry. I didn't recognize that my attitudes or the way I expressed anger was really anger in me. And I do remember, and this was many years ago, but I remember boasting to somebody close to me, "I'm not angry." And that friend turned around to me and said, "Brian, you're one of the angriest people I know." Well, I want to tell you, that shocked me. But it shocked me into awareness. You see, I didn't realize that anger manifests itself in different ways, and that I might not really understand the anger in me and how I express it. But I found out at that time, after that, that as I talked to other close people, that those people around me sure understand my anger, and I'm glad they were honest with me and helped me to address it. And I'm glad I had somewhere, as I became a Christian, I'm glad I found the Lord to help me to deal with that. So this morning, we want to look at what Jesus Christ said about handling anger. And we're in our series, A Closer Look at the Kingdom of God. And we're looking at these righteous relationships. So as I've already mentioned, this follows up what we saw last time, that Jesus, speaking to the disciples, said this shocking statement. He said, "Unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven." That had to come across as a thoroughly shocking statement, because to the disciples, to the Jewish mindset, the Pharisees were the most righteous. They weren't loved, they weren't appreciated, they were feared, but they were certainly understood to be righteous because that's what they were supposed to be, and they appeared to apply the law down to the tiniest detail. And here is Jesus saying to his disciples, who were primarily at that time four fishermen and tax collectors and zealots and really not people thought of as righteous, and he's saying, "You've got to be more righteous than those that are considered righteous here in Israel." So we want to look at that today and next week in a practical sense, and start by just looking at one example, the example of anger in our interpersonal relationships. So before we talk about how Jesus said to deal with it, I want to examine anger, and I want to understand what happens when we get angry. What's going on when we get angry? So there's two aspects I want us to realize. First of all is, I just want to say before that both of these aspects are within the framework of what Jesus is talking about, but there's two different Greek words, which we won't go into what they are, at least right now, but those words speak to these two aspects. And the first aspect is anger as a reaction. So it's our passionate outburst, our anger that flares up. This guy he's got his cell phone and he's reacting. It's anger as a natural reaction to something that happened to us. So when we have that natural reaction, there's a physiological response in our bodies. Our blood shifts from our stomach to our heart. Our central nervous system kicks in. Our muscles tense. Our sugar is released from the reserves in our spleen, and the adrenaline in our body starts pumping. So we may not recognize all these things are going on, but when we're reacting in anger, that's what's going on. And then our emotions kick in, and the visceral response, the feelings that bubble to the surface. So that's the initial reaction to something in anger. But the second aspect is what I call the response aspect. The reaction is something happens and we react. But the response is ongoing. What happens after? What happens the rest of that time? What happens that day or the next day or on and on? So we have a reaction and we have a response. We have an abiding condition. We have an ongoing mental state, and however privately or publicly we display our anger, there's something still there. And the question is, well, what will I do with my anger? Will I ignore it? Should I just pretend that I'm not angry? Will I deny it? If somebody says, what are you angry about? And I say, who, me, angry? No. Will I rationalize it? Well, hey, that's just me. That's just the way I am. I can't change, can I? Or will I feed it? Some people feed on their anger because it is an emotional high, and they love that feeling. I know I had somebody in one church that loved to get people angry, because when he got others angry, it got him pumped up, and he looked for confrontations. And I didn't realize that at first. And then after a while, I kind of watched this person. I thought, man, this guy stokes the fires. We need to address this. So there are many ways to respond to our anger. And we're going to look at how Jesus tells us to respond. But I want us to see, first of all, what are some of the conditions that might create anger in our lives? And tell me if you think these might relate to you. What are some of the conditions? The first condition is blocked goals. So we have a goal, we have something we want, and we can't get there. And so that leads to frustration. And frustration is anger, but just kind of a muted anger, an anger that's kind of held in. When I'm frustrated, I want something, whether it's money or an experience, or I want you to do something or somebody to do something, and I'm frustrated. But when I'm frustrated, what's really going on is I'm angry, but I don't know what to do with it. So that's one condition, block goals. Do you relate to that? Secondly is unmet expectations. When I'm disappointed, when something I hoped for or believed would happen but didn't happen, I get down and I have unmet expectations and I get angry. If you've read my book on what do you expect, you know that I consider an anger as an alarm that goes off in me. So when I'm angry, I'm going, well, what expectation is not being met? What am I not getting that I thought I would get? The third thing is personal rejection, where some person or some people, usually significant people, leave you out or ignore you. And you're left feeling hurt or threatened. And you may pretend it doesn't matter, but inside you're seething. We were kind of looking for something to watch on television this week, and somebody recommended that we watch the final presentation by the comedian Ellen DeGeneres. And I haven't really followed her trajectory too much. I remember reading stuff about her in the past, but she pointed out in this final special that she did that 2 years ago, after 19 years being very successful with a talk show, she was then labeled as the world's worst boss. She said, and being a comedian, she said, how do you get labeled the world's worst boss? She said, I don't even know who else was in the running. which I thought was a great line because, yeah, if I'm the world's worst boss, who else, who was I up against? But anyway, here she said that people, up until this time, she was loved, and all of a sudden, she was rejected, and she lost her job. She lost her work. She lost the things she loved. But she tried to act as though it didn't matter. But she said, inside, I was seething. And it took a lot. And I thought, there's an example of what I'm talking about this week. Somebody who felt totally loved. They had a television audience, and they had the audience being recorded. They had the audience at home and everything. And she feels loved for all this time. And then she's rejected. And I thought, wow, personal rejection. But maybe you felt it. Have you ever felt that rejection? Somebody leaves you? Your church, your job, something pushes you out? Number four is the loss of something valued, whether it's your job, whether it's a relationship, whatever it is, whatever you value, something's been lost. And you become angry about it because you didn't want to lose it. You didn't look for that. And the final condition, although there's many, many more, but one more is a learned response. Some of us just have anger built in because we've learned that in the family we grew up in, or we learned it from the people around us, or the people that we work with. We just develop it from them. But what we do know is that every day there are conditions around us that set us up for anger. And we may feel helpless. We may feel like, well, anger is just inevitable, so what can I do? Or we may feel guilty. We may say, hey, look, at when I'm angry, I apologize and I ask God's forgiveness, but then hours later I'm doing the same thing again. It's just a cycle I go through. So I know, like, when we look at anger, it can be a clinical kind of thing. But what we want to do is get beyond that to the practicality. Now, it's interesting to note that many circumstances may anger us, but I looked up studies on anger, and one that interested me was a study done in around 2000 using college students to keep a record of what angered them in a week. 80% of what created anger in them was another person. The most common source of anger was the personal relationship. So that's an important factor. It isn't the only one we've seen with all those conditions, but personal relationships definitely have a place in creating anger in us. Now, the one caution I'd say is we can't say, you made me angry, you made me mad. That anger is my response. Anger is my choice. How I handle it is my choice. That person might have done something that I didn't like, but they didn't make me angry. I am angry either as a reaction, which is normal, or an ongoing response, which doesn't need to happen. So what's going on when we're angry? Let's follow this through together, shall we? So something happens to trigger us, an event triggers us and triggers the anger in me, the reaction, the immediate reaction. We already mentioned that. It's something happens and an immediate reaction takes place, physiological and emotional. And that's involuntary. That just happens. But my response is a voluntary one that can either be constructive or destructive. So follow the two outward and inward elements of anger. Outwardly, my response can be one of rage, just like we saw that character from Inside Out. And the rage turns into a tantrum where I blow up. And then if I'm destructive, I ridicule or look for revenge. I want to hit back. That was something I didn't realize was anger in me, is I was very vengeful. I didn't realize how I began to plot revenge when somebody did something to me. Inside, I was plotting revenge and didn't realize it. And then finally, it leads to domineering. You want to control. So outwardly, the response, the ongoing response, follows that pattern down in those different ways. They're all aspects of anger, but things that we may not realize are happening in us. We may not realize that wanting to control others is my anger. Wanting to domineer people is my anger. Wanting to ridicule people or be vengeful is my anger. But if what happens when we don't project it, when it's inward? Well, when it's inward, it's resentment. And that resentment turns to bitterness. Hebrews 12 talks about let no bitter root grow up in you to defile many. And I remember several years ago when I lost something that I loved, bitterness was starting in me. And I realized as I was journaling about it, I had to say no to bitterness every day. It was there, and I had to say no because that bitterness was there because I felt like I had not been treated well. If I don't deal with the bitterness, it becomes self-destructive. It eats away at me. I like what somebody said. Bitterness is like drinking poison and waiting for the other person to die. And I sure understood that. Because the poison is really in me. It's not in them. If I'm bitter about a situation, that's not going to affect the other person. It only affects me. But the ultimate part of it is withdrawal. The outward is we domineer, but inward we hide away. I'm not going to get out there. I'm going to just hide away in here. I know that this is pretty simple look at a complex issue, but it's a backdrop to the subject of what Jesus is talking about. So now let's look at how Jesus says we are to righteously respond to anger. And the first thing we want to see is that Jesus says an angry heart is worthy of judgment. Look at what he says. You have heard that it was said to people long ago, you shall not murder. And anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, Raca, is answerable to the court. And anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. Okay, so Jesus begins by using a formula that he will use to introduce all six of these examples. You have heard that it was said. Now, I want to clarify, he's not saying that the law was wrong. He's not saying, okay, here was the Ten Commandments or the Law of Moses. You heard that, but it's wrong. No, no, no. Jesus just a couple of sentences before said, I haven't come to abolish the law, but to what? To fulfill it. I've come to fulfill the law because it is totally righteous. So Jesus isn't saying that the problem is with the law. But he's saying, you've heard that it was said to the people long ago, you shall not murder. And anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. Now that, try and look that up in the Old Testament, you won't find it. It'll say, you shall not murder, but it doesn't say the second part. And it's not talking there about God's judgment, it's talking about the law courts. But what Jesus is saying is, somebody has taken the Old Testament law, and they're kind of twisting it for their own purposes. And that, of course, is the Pharisees. And he's saying their oral law, the oral law of the scribes and Pharisees, the religious leaders, has actually diluted the law. We'll see that next week with each of the examples. So Jesus takes them back to the Ten Commandments with, yes, you shall not murder, but he takes them inside to look at the inner heart condition, not just the action of murder, but the inner heart behind it. And he says, I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. So we see that not only is this a kingdom matter between God's kingdom, but it's also a family member within in there. Again, he's not talking about the natural brother or sister, even though that could be, but it's your brothers and sisters within the kingdom of God. He's speaking to disciples. He's not expecting somebody from outside the kingdom to apply this. Doesn't mean you don't want them to, but we as kingdom people, we as followers of Jesus, are the brothers and sisters. Notice that Jesus doesn't wink at anger. He doesn't make an excuse for anger. He doesn't brush it off. He deals with anger head on. He says, anyone who says to their brother or sister, raka, is answerable to the court. It's always interesting where they translate in whichever translation of the Bible you're using, where they just leave the word. That's an Aramaic word. Anybody here use the word raka? No. Maybe rock a roll, but when Steve's playing guitar, I think, rock on, brother. But no, but that's not what I'm talking about. It's raka. What does raka mean? Well, raka is an Aramaic word, and it means empty-headed. It's a term of contempt. It's like saying, you dummy. That's what you're saying. You're empty-headed. You're dummy. And then he goes on, and anyone who says, you fool. Now, you fool comes from the Greek word where we get the English word moron. You moron. When I hear the word moron, I think of growing up watching the Three Stooges and Moe calling Curly and Larry morons. And we know who really was the moron. Anyway. But anger is displayed, again, in ridiculing other people, a sister or a brother-in-law, not necessarily murdering them, but killing them softly with the words they say. Now, you may say, well, what's wrong with that? Because we live in a cynical, sarcastic time. Certainly when you watch, I mentioned watching one comedian, when you watch comedy on television or in a movie or something like that, you notice there's a lot of cynicism and sarcasm in there. Jesus says this because he's dealing with the purity of our relationships. I want to point out as well where else in the Bible this is said, and Ian Campbell's been doing the series on James. He's continued to do that. And when we pick these series to do, we kind of pick them both because James and the Sermon on the Mount kind of go parallel. They don't go line for line, but James is definitely aware of his half-brother Jesus' Sermon on the Mount and probably use that as his backdrop. But he says in James 1:19-20, my dear brothers and sisters, there it is, take note of this. Everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry, because human anger does not produce the righteousness that God desires. There it is. Anger is the opposite of what righteousness is. We don't have to physically murder somebody. We can kill their reputation. We can use sarcasm and slander, choice words that may make other people laugh but cripples them. And Jesus warns those of us who are part of the kingdom, there's no room for that ongoing response to anger. So our anger brings us to God's judgment, and that's crucial to begin with. We need to understand, first of all, that anger isn't something to just, what are you going to do? Anger is something that brings us to God's judgment. So secondly, he wants us to see that we are to put a high priority on personal reconciliation. We're to put a high priority on personal reconciliation. So he says in verse 23, therefore, based on everything he said before, if you're offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to them. Then come and offer your gift. Do you see the priority? First go and be reconciled, even before you worship. It's interesting to see that God doesn't want our worship if our family connections aren't in place. Over my many years of pastoring, I've led communion countless times. But in one of my pastorates, I was in a relationship that I had not sorted out with a brother. And it came to the morning that we're having communion. We had it once a month in that church. And I knew I couldn't take communion. And I was serving it. But I said to the congregation, I'm serving communion, but I can't partake of it. Because I'm in a relationship with a brother that is not sorted out. And I have to first go and deal with it. That had a very powerful impact on some people. They said, I've never seen a pastor or a worship leader ever do that. And I said, well, I think you have to. I think if you're not in a right relationship with a brother or sister, you better go and deal with that first. And so I tell you, if you're not in a right relationship with someone this morning, you maybe don't want to do this. You don't have to take communion. Now, I know the embarrassment when people don't. I know what, you know, people say to me, oh, you know, if I don't go up, people are going to go, what's wrong with you? Well, maybe you need to tell them what's wrong with them. Maybe you need to get them to pray for you. Paul said in Ephesians, he said, in your anger, do not sin. You see, anger is normal as a reaction. If you're angry, that's normal. If something happened and you're angry, okay. But that's no excuse to sin. In your anger, he says, don't sin. He said, don't let the sun go down while you're still angry, and don't give the devil a foothold. So he acknowledges that anger is there, but you can't let anger become the base camp for sin in your life. If we just leave the anger there, whether it's bitterness or rage or whatever it is, if we leave it there, it becomes the base camp in which all the other sins begin to happen. The devil gets a foothold and he pushes us into more. And I know from experience, our tendency is to put it off, is to procrastinate. I'll get around to it. I'll do it sooner or later. But he's saying, deal with it before the sun goes down. He's saying there's an urgency to deal with it. I know that reconciliation is awkward. I've been in so many relationships, whether it's me at fault or somebody else at fault, where the reconciliation is awkward as all get out. I've sat in a room with people and a mediator with us, and it was totally awkward because neither side wanted to give an inch. But the best thing we could do is admit, this is awkward. How do we reconcile? We need to, because we're brothers and sisters in the Lord. Our priority is on personal reconciliation. And the final thing I want to say is that we are to take the initiative to restore peace as we replace anger. We are to take the initiative. We just saw that in these personal cases of dealing with a brother or sister in the Lord, if someone has something against us, who is responsible for dealing with it? We are responsible. I am responsible. He says, if you're offering your gift at the altar, if you're going there to worship, and remember that your brother or sister has something against you. Okay, I'm going to worship, and uh-oh, my brother or sister in the Lord has something against me. He says, leave your gift and go and be reconciled to them. He doesn't say, pray that they will come and sort things out with you. He says, you go. You go. You are accountable. You are responsible. We are responsible and accountable to initiate reconciliation and peace. I know from years of doing counseling that one of the questions I always ask people is, you know, how does your relationship work? And so often people say to me, well, it's a 50-50 proposition. I said, then it'll never work. What do you mean, Brian? How can it not work if it's 50-50? I said, no. It's 100-100. You have to bring 100. Well, what if I bring 100 and they only bring 20? You are only responsible for you. If you want to bring them to the next counseling session, we'll talk about their 20. But all they may ever do is 20. But you are responsible for your 100. I know that comes as a shock to people because I've watched people go, I never thought of it. I always thought of it as 50-50. I said, I know, I was there too. But Jesus says it's 100-100. Jesus then stretches the instruction beyond brothers and sisters. So it's not just a family member, it's the way we deal with all people. So it's not just other Christians, it's how we deal with others. He says, settle matters quickly with your adversary who's taking you to court. So this is a legal thing. This is somebody else. It's not necessarily a brother or sister in the Lord. It's an adversary taking you to court. He says, do it while you're still together on your way, or your adversary may hand you over to the judge. The judge may hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown into prison, and truly I tell you, you will not get out until you've paid the last penny. So he's using the court system that they all understood in the Hebrew world, or the Jewish world at that time. But, and we'll pick up next week how Jesus says to respond to enemies in the six things, but here he's speaking specifically of an adversary, somebody who has a legal argument against us, somebody who has something on that can take us to court, and righteousness and justice is to be found here. Both in these situations, whether it's the family of God or a relationship with somebody else, the stress is really on the urgency. Deal with it now. He says, settle matters quickly with your adversary. Do it while you're still together on the way. He says, don't even get to court. Deal with them. He said, you know, stop. Let's reconcile right now. Let's sort this out right here. We take the initiative and we do it now. This takes us back into the Beatitudes. Remember the Beatitude? Blessed are the peacemakers, not the peacekeepers. Not people who just want to keep everything nice and quiet, but the peacemakers who are saying, I need to reconcile. I need to rebuild. Jesus wants us to be peacemakers, not just that we say, I'm a peacemaker. That's who I am. But a peacemaker, that's what I do. You see, if you're a peacemaker, I should be able to come up to you and say, give me an example of how you made peace in your life. And you should be able to give me at least one example, if not many. We are accountable for the initiation. We don't wait for others. We're the ones that do it. Now, from experience, I know that this only works sometimes. But we don't do it because it works. That's pragmatism, only doing things because they work. Why do we do this? We do it because we are accountable to do it. It takes two parties to reconcile, but we have to bring our 100% to the table. Paul said to the Romans in chapter 12, if it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. So he simply says in that wonderful Romans 12 chapter, as far as you're concerned, do your part. And the context of that is revenge. The next verse he says, don't take revenge, my dear friends, but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, it is mine to avenge, I will repay. So he's saying, it's not that God will not allow vengeance to happen, but God will mete out the vengeance in his time, in his way. I'm not the venge taker. He says, on the contrary, here is something you can do. And then he quotes Proverbs 25, 21, and 22. If your enemy is hungry, excuse me, feed him. And if he's thirsty, give him something to drink. And in doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head. Don't become overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. We heap burning coals on their head, and that's really that idea that of all the warmth, they're flushed with shame because you're treating them so well when they've treated you so poorly. So we see from this that the urgency of dealing with it. So in conclusion, I just want to come back and say, how are you doing with your anger? Are you dealing with it in short order? Are you recognizing it? Or do you need a friend to come along and say, you're pretty angry, you know? As you begin the new year, what relationships does God want you to sort through? Is there a relationship in this room? Is there a relationship in your family? Is there a relationship at work or somewhere else? I want you to just close your eyes for a moment and pray quietly to the Lord yourself. And just ask the Holy Spirit to search you and see if there might be a name or names or face that he brings to mind that he wants you to deal with.
Thank you for listening to the Groundswell podcast. For more info or to support Groundswell, check out www.thegroundswellchurch.com. Grace and peace.